Here at Strange Magic, Amanda and I talk about our views on tarot and the ways in which we practice magic.
And we understand that other people have different ways of practicing and different interpretations of the tarot, and that's totally okay.
Take what you'd like and leave the rest.
Hello, 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 everyone. We're back with a vengeance.
We're here. I can't believe we are on season 3.
I am so glad to be here because we get to talk about some of the best, the most troubling, the most dazzling, the most starlit, star-crossed, fascinating cards in the tarot deck.
Indeed.
And we get to talk to each other and we get to share our views with our beautiful, lovely, genius, starlit listeners.
Speaking of gorgeous, beautiful, starlit listeners, we really just want to start this episode off by thanking all of you.
From the bottom of our witchy hearts, we thank you so much for tuning in, for listening, for contributing, for being coven members, for contributing at whatever level you contribute. For tuning in, for giving us stars, for giving us likes, for giving us ratings. Just thank you for existing. Thank you for being witches out there. Thank you for your interest in tarot. We love you so much, and we are so glad to have you here. We are so impressed with you.
And honestly, when we started this podcast, it was very much on a whim. We really did not know what was going to happen or if anyone was even going to listen. And you did. So thank you for that. And also, we decided last season that because, you know, I'm going to be transparent, this podcast is quite a bit of time and effort and energy for the three of us involved. And it was costing us money to, you know, have the bandwidth and all of the boring things that none of you want to hear about. We decided that we needed support. We needed to have support. And we put out a call for those of you to be our coveners and support us monthly in exchange for supporting the podcast and also receiving a workshop every other month or every 6 weeks and a live call every month. And you helped us and we're here.
We're so grateful.
As of right now, we're about 1/3 of the way to our goal to keep the podcast running. So that's just like, we text about it. Our hearts are warm. We're so humbled and honored to serve all of our coveners. And if you want to get more information about joining the coven, you can go to our website. We'll put the link in the show notes, but we do have an upcoming workshop next month. And so you'll be able to get that in exchange for supporting us. There's lots of other things we're cooking up for our coven members and our other financial supporters. So, you know, if you have any questions, you can email us or you can go on our website to find out more about that.
Probably, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I'm going to have a podcast. And that's kind of what we did. But we didn't realize that each of us spends probably at like 15 hours a week, at least working on this podcast, was just like another job, which most people, including us very much, most of us can't do a part-time job without getting paid for it. So when we put out that call to have you guys support us, it meant so much to us because we're doing this thing that we love doing and we're trying to offer it in the spirit of like love and gratitude. And then y'all supported us. And that just made us feel like, wow, the world is good and like things can happen. Magic can take place and we can all support each other and create communities and economic systems where we all reward each other for doing meaningful work. And that we should all be able to do that.
And not everyone can support us financially. And if you love the podcast and want to support us in other ways, it's really simple. You can give us a 5-star review and rating on Apple Podcasts.
That makes a huge difference.
If you've already done that, you can tell your friends. Word of mouth is really huge. You can just text your friend, hey, I love this podcast. I think you'd like it.
Yeah, I love that idea, Sarah. It's like, what a fun thing, right? Like, you can know that if you're telling someone how much you love the podcast, that you are doing a good deed on our behalf.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not just financial. So, you know, we also have just a couple other little quick announcements we want to talk about. My Many Moons 2020 Lunar Planner is officially going to the printers, I think today, the day Yay! That we're dropping this. So that means it'll be out in about a month and we'll be shipping it. So if you want to learn more about that project that I've been spending the past 6 months doing, you can go to the link in the show notes or go to modernwomenprojects.bigcartel.com for that. And Amanda, I know there is another exciting project on its way.
Well, I just want to say I'm so excited about that planner and I am buying one. Ka-ching for sure, straight away.
$3.99 for you, your contributor. Babe,
thank you. Yeah, so my book is coming out on October 22nd. It's available for pre-order now. And I just wanted to save myself a little bit of feeling awkward and let someone else praise it. So I'm going to read you a little bit of a review by Gina Balabrera Amix, who works at the Literary Bookstore in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she left this review on this indie website that helps booksellers review and rate books. And it made me cry and just like had me in so much tears. Felt really seen. She says, "This book is stunning. Yais Garcia's writing is incredibly compelling and precise, which elevates the book above and beyond a simple classification in memoir or new age. She's writing a family history, a feminist lineage, and taking down the white capitalist patriarchy that colonizes even the most evolved minds among us. And she's brilliant, literary, and very funny. This book contains angels, egregores of many shapes and tempers. Her descriptions of the turn of the millennium San Francisco hipster and cluttered shotgun Victorians are so vivid I can smell the Nag Champa and mold in the walls. Epigraphs from Anne Waldman and Helen Csiksu's frame these chapters, and Yais Garcia is not afraid to critique the problematic limitations of popular applications of New Age and Wicca practices." And she goes on, and she says, "Witchcraft in this book is much larger than New Age culture. Witching speaks to the power of women and femmes to create a just and loving community. Garcia's witchcraft is magic, and it is listening to intuition as much as her witchcraft also refers to the rigor and inspiration and craft of making art and a revolutionary commitment to breaking cycles of violence, spells, in the name of creating a better world. Gina Balabrera Amix, thank you. I feel seen. I love you. I want to visit your bookstore." And yes, if that sounded good to you, please buy my book, Initiated. You can find it on my website. You can just Google it and buy it via the Grand Central Hachette, the Hachette site, or any place books are sold. Thank you.
Amanda, I am so excited to talk about our subject today. We are talking about the cards of the year of our year, Gregorian year, 2019.
2019, here we are. You know, we did this episode at the beginning of the year. We talked about cards of the year. And so the question is, maybe some of our listeners are thinking, why are they doing this again? Well, this is to help you get the most out of working with your card of the year. It's not just do it at the beginning of the year and forget. It's work throughout the year and gain a deep understanding. Because, you know, I think a lot of the time with witchcraft, with spirituality in general, we have this like roving mind. We're always looking for more, for another thing. We pull a new card every day. But there's so much to be said for going deeper, to really getting to know something, a card, and creating a sense of intimacy with it. That depth of knowledge is, for me, so much more useful than breadth of knowledge. So that's why we're revisiting this today.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the other thing is that our episode way back when was so speculative. We didn't know what was going to happen this year in an Empress year and in a Hanged One year or the Hanged Man year. So it's interesting now to look at the collective energies of these archetypes and talk about how we've seen this play out in both micro and macro ways. Obviously, we all have our own individual precognitive biases. I have to say, just personally, last year was so strongly High Priestess Justice, and we can see this and how certain things played out in the political realm and in, you know, on the global realm. And we can really see also now in this year a lot of correlations to the Empress and Hanged Man, and looking at the energies of the collective cards of the year can offer all of us food for thought, or at least give us some ideas for praxis in our own lives. And we're going to dig into some of those ways today.
Absolutely, we will. And we'll also be talking about how we work with our personal cards of the year. And whenever we talk about personal stuff, it's not just because we like to overshare about our personal lives. Even if my moon is in Leo, LOL, I do love to shine my light on my life. But we talk about personal stuff on the show and our personal cards because we believe that by seeing how we apply this stuff to our own lives, you might get some inspiration about how the energies might be at work in your life. In my book, or in Sarah's, the chapbook that you wrote about your spiritual crisis, for instance, you know, we talk about our own stories, but that's so that you can see how that reflects on your own story, your own power, your story of wrestling with what witchcraft and spirituality and the goddess means to you, or what tarot means to you. We do that so that you can see it in your own life.
Totally. I think we should just dive right in.
Let's do it. Okay. I re-listened to the episode 13, which was the Cards of the Year episode from the beginning of the year.
This is episode 30. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. We're doing so great.
We've made much content.
30 episodes.
But so I re-listened to that episode and I was like, damn, we were on a roll, because we really, there was a lot of stuff that we brought up that is, in fact, devastatingly, in many of the cases, actually happened. So first of all, Empress and the Hanged Man, if you listen to that episode 13 again, you'll see we talked a lot about the environment and threats to the environment, and how we expected that things might really heat up in that regard. In fact, we've seen the fires in the Amazon, the fires in the Arctic, in deserts, the loss of billions of birds. One out of every four songbirds in America has died over the past 50 years. Huge mass extinction events. And then there's Trump literally rolling back environmental protections, like Californians' ability to limit pollution. Which, like, when you heard that, were you like, what the fuck is he thinking? I'm sure you were. But we also see the rise of feminine forms of power, feminine resistance, Greta Thunberg. I'm thinking of also, when I'm thinking of this environmental challenge that we're facing, I'm thinking of the Hanged One, as I remember you talking about this in The Hanged Man, as the man on the gallows, you know, after being sentenced by justice. And in some ways, we can see that the chickens have come home to roost, and we are walking up on that gallows as a species. We cannot continue to do as we've been doing. We're tightening our own noose. And I'm grateful that next year adds up to the emperor rather than death, because I feel like it means that we can revision how power operates in the world.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up in particular, because we'll talk about this more when it's time for that. But yeah, I mean, everything that you said, Amanda, I think about AOC and the Green New Deal. I think there needs to be some kind of particular word in the English language that both talks, like there's this beauty in the tragedy or little glimmers of hope or things to offer us resilience in the sense of, yes, we are in a crisis. Yes, we are in the apocalypse. Yes, that is our reality. And also we're seeing finally, you know, because people have been telling us about all of this stuff for decades and decades. Scientists and environmental activists have really been wanting to get our attention about this.
Indigenous people have been talking
about it. Indigenous people for hundreds of years. So, you know, finally on a bit more of a main stage where we are, we're seeing the Green New Deal and AOC talking about this and Bernie Sanders, and we're seeing folks talk more and more about the intersections of race and class and the environment, and we're seeing Elizabeth Warren talk about how, yes, we can recycle or, you know, buy metal straws, but really it's corporations. The U.S. military is the biggest polluter in the world, in addition to being the biggest colonizer. You know, like, we see all of these things, we are seeing the system, and finally we're also seeing people in positions of power who have the opportunity to talk about these things, finally talking about these things, which for me is slightly giving me hope, you know. And that's not to say that as individuals we also as individuals have to do things, but it's also like finally people are saying what we've all been talking about on the ground, what we've all been thinking about, what we've been talking about over the kitchen table, or, you know, all of these things. So
Extinction Rebellion, just even today when we're recording this, was this worldwide environmental climate crisis strike and march. All over the world, people are rising up in resistance and are going to reclaim the commons, reclaim the world as a place of sacredness. And so we do see this relationship between the Empress and the Hanged One, right? That stuckness, that resistance, and that coming to awareness, and also the Empress as nature, as...
Well, that radical acceptance around nature,
yeah,
right? That, like, this is what we have, this is what we're doing. That's totally Empress and Hanged One together.
Absolutely, yeah.
I also am thinking about the Empress and the Hanged One play out in the continuation of the changing of the structures of power, namely how women and feminine folks are treated on a basic level, how men and abusers are now, a little bit at least now, being held more accountable than they've ever been, at least for abuses of assault, of sexual assault, of rape, of racist actions. Again, I'm saying barely, that is true. But I do believe that we are seeing change and that we will continue to see this change in our lifetime. We see the continuation of Tarana Burke's Me Too movement and this year's themes of men in power being taken down because they're horrific abusers. Obviously, I'm thinking of Harvey Weinstein. I'm thinking of literally Jeffrey Epstein as the Hanged Man.
Oh my God, right?
Literally.
A literal representation of the Hanged Man.
And the Empress.
Right? How are you seeing it as the Empress?
Well, he abused women.
Right.
And as a result, he was held accountable.
Right.
And then decided to take his life.
Right. Because he couldn't take responsibility. Like, he couldn't face his own...
And what he did to the Empress.
Right, exactly.
You know, I think about R. Kelly with the Mute R. Kelly movement and Dream Hampton and everyone who aided them. Like, the Mute R. Kelly movement and Dream Hampton are the Empress, you know, and then we have the person on the gallows, R. Kelly, you know, all of the resurgences that are happening right now in the Kavanaugh case, like coming to light. You know,
Carolyn, our producer, is like throwing a party about this. She's so ready for that.
How that links us, because we think about the Empress and cycles of time and seasons, how that links us back to Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill.
Mm.
Did you know that Christine
and Joe Biden?
And Joe Biden. Yeah, totally. Right. Yes. Thank you, producer Carolyn. Did you also know that Christine Blasey Ford is still in hiding? She still can't work and she's still getting death threats.
It's so
High Priestess Shocking, Justice.
Infuriating.
I also think about the Empress and the Hanged One as Nancy Pelosi holding off on the impeachment hearings, which should have started years ago, right? The Empress holding it up, like holding it back, you know?
In a tangle with a Hanged Man.
These are all different takes on the archetypes, but they also resonate. So when we start focusing and thinking about this, we can see the dichotomous archetypes popping up everywhere in the landscape of American culture.
Totally. Well, so some of the things that I was thinking about...
A little more pleasant, maybe?
I'm not sure if it's more pleasant, but okay. I think it's interesting. Okay, so for those of you who maybe haven't listened to previous episodes, The Hanged Man is about accepting your uncomfortable position, right? It's about being in a stress position and just kind of coming to peace with that instead of trying to fight it. And so I was thinking about this mindfulness takedown that's been going on. Have you heard about this, Sarah?
Tell me more.
So there's a really interesting article came out in The Guardian by this academic, Ronald Purser, and the essay was called The Mindfulness Conspiracy. And so basically, mindfulness is sold to us as something that will help us cope with the ravages of capitalism, right? But it focuses us inward, and in fact, it might make it so that it's the enemy of activism. Basically, what he's saying is that mindfulness does help us cope with intolerable situations, but that is also kind of part of the problem. So if corporate headquarters is paying for a mindfulness retreat for you, it might not be out of the goodness of their heart. It might just be so that you'll deal with the fact that you're doing meaningless work and not spending enough time doing the things that you love.
It's like the new vodka in the fridge, so you stay late right? at night so you can just have free snacks and alcohol.
Google's so nice for providing this vodka for me so I can get drunk and stay here for another 5 hours. But okay, so he says anything that offers success in our unjust society without trying to change it is not revolutionary. It just helps people cope. So he's saying mindfulness is nothing more than basic concentration training. So it's training you to be able to concentrate and not notice all the things that are getting, you know, like your aching back, your sore wrists, like the fact that your partner is like sick, the fact that your cat is having some kind of issue, you're focusing on getting that email done. So, but one of the things that he says is really interesting is he says that although it's derived from Buddhism, it's been stripped of all the teachings of the ethics that accompany Buddhism. Huh. As well as the liberating aim of dissolving attachment to a false sense of self while enacting compassion for other beings. So Buddhism is in many ways revolutionary because it's asking us to have compassion for all beings and to work towards their liberation. And so what this reminds me of is that like what we're seeing now within the spiritual collective is a reckoning of that kind where we're really addressing this kind of spiritual bypassing and cultural appropriation where especially like white people or the dominant culture takes little bits of cultures like Native American sweat lodges or something. All the things that are palatable and pleasing to the dominant culture are included, but the things that are revolutionary, the things that are like take the boot off our neck, the things that are like you need to stand up and rise up in resistance and support of your fellow humans and your the planet and the rivers and the oceans, we're just not going to talk about that part, right? We're going to leave that part out because we don't like it. But so I think that's really interesting that this essay came out this year, you know, in this Hanging One year, which is really about reckoning with this idea of acceptance and what acceptance means. So I don't think he's saying that mindfulness is bad. It's
how it's being used, right?
Yes, exactly.
Just like spirituality.
Exactly. A truly revolutionary movement, he says, would seek to overturn this dysfunctional system. So It's not revolutionary if it only serves to reinforce the destructive logic of capitalism. We're going to include that essay in the show notes, but I think it's really relevant. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that we see this sort of like knee jerk or impulse to take what is going to help us do X, Y, Z, like you were saying, the mindfulness without the sort of larger awareness of the collective or the system. We can see how any kind of spirituality can be used to dominate or to uphold very problematic viewpoints. Like we see it with, I don't really want to get too much into it because we will have many opportunities to get into it more in further episodes, but just dominant spiritual culture of that sort of at the top of the food chain, so to speak, is this slender, white, cisgendered, wealthy, affluent, straight woman. And that if you too do what she does, you too can be enlightened, but by enlightened, safe, and by safe, upholder, as Rebecca Traister says, as a foot soldier of the white supremacist patriarchy. You know, we see this everywhere. And we're also seeing interrogations happening in various communities. We're seeing it in the spiritual community or the larger spiritual community. It's nowhere where it needs to be, but it is happening. And in order for it to truly happen, white folks need to stop appropriating. They need to stop continuing on with settler colonial violence in their practices and their theft and what they're selling, and obviously give space to folks of color. We have to stop perpetuating harm in the name of healing, right? Right. And that's like, that's insidious. And I think that sort of gets to what you were talking about in that article, you know, that's in the show notes, of like just saying, oh, this is the way to do it. And this can uphold my viewpoint of the binary or, you know, whatever the dominant kind of culture is. 100%. I also can't help but see the kind of Empress Hainwen energy of people wanting to evolve and wanting to bend more towards restorative justice and wanting to work through these messy and difficult topics of racism and power and privilege, because we know we have to in order to move forward, right? And I also think about the divine femme and the divine feminine getting more and more enlightened and more complex and more holographic, wanting to grow, wanting to change beyond gender essentialism. You know, like we have the God X. Mm. The dictionary just added they as an official pronoun. Like these are just kind of some examples. So I also wanted to talk about, like, on that tip of evolution, my favorite topic.
Is it?
Well, it's like never ending, right? It's like,
in fact, literally,
it's like the hedonist ladder, but with less pain maybe, or something, or maybe with more pain, I don't know. But I do want to talk about going off the Empress and the Hanged One and this idea of enlightenment and feminine enlightenment. I want to talk about the evolution of feminism internally, not just the effect that, you know, feminism has had on the culture with Me Too and what I sort of spoke about earlier, but I sort of want to really point out that, in my humble opinion, I think truly within feminist discourse, we are seeing, fortunately, a pull to truly the intersectional. I think we're seeing more nuanced and complex conversations happening, you know, intersectional feminists, radical feminists. They don't just like simply wish to be equal to men. That's like not what we want, right? That's like a psychic and actual death wish, right? We want to tear down the entire system so everyone can feel free and safe and protected, not just white rich people, you know, where we're truly moving towards a community of care. And that's going to require a lot of unprogramming, a lot of conversations, a lot of critical thinking. And a lot of that is going to require many folks, myself included, to actually walk the walk, not just sort of stay in the safe zone or do things for accolades or for the ego. And that's going to require fortitude, forgiveness, authenticity. I also think about how, in quotes, white feminism is just not cutting it anymore, even on a mainstream level. The book She Said just came out, and there are these blistering indictments about these white women, powerful feminist lawyers, Linda Bloom and Gina Allred. They are these, like, on paper, these harbingers of, like, feminist equality. And behind the scenes, they were aiding Weinstein.
That's just so unbelievable.
They were covering up abuse. They really, like, on paper were like, we're going to end this. And they're getting paid, like, $900 an hour to do research on Rose McGowan for Harvey Weinstein to take her down.
How dare they?
You can read the book. And then there's also these really great episodes that you can listen to for free on The Daily that, like, covers this.
I listened to that one on The Daily, yeah.
It's so wild. So it's like, we know now that, like, truly being an intersectional feminist is so much more than saying that you are one. And I really do think that we're moving more and more into a time that, on a personal level and even on a larger level, we're, like, evolving what this looks like and what this can be. I'm seeing it in the House of Representatives with the Squad. I'm seeing it with Deb Haaland of New Mexico and Therese Davids of Kansas, who are the first Indigenous congresswomen ever.
That is so shocking and horrifying that they are the first Indigenous women, but, like, in the history of a nation that is built on Indigenous soil. But it is so uplifting and wonderful.
It's that word. It's like this horrible thing.
Yeah.
And this good, it's like, I don't know what the word is, but so, you know, we're seeing this happen. We're seeing this, I think, on a micro level and personally, like, we're trying to show up and be the best that we can to really, really, really shift our thinking and how we treat one another. And it's really hard. It's like, it's difficult. And the hanged one-ness of it literally requires the pleasure of the Empress.
Yeah, I love that turn at the end. It's so interesting. What I hear you saying is basically that, you know, the Empress is about this sort of divine feminine, feminix energy. And that the Hanged One is the energy of discomfort and being in that. And that this year is calling us to enter into the realms of the Godex and be and deal with the parts that make us uncomfortable and really reckon with our karmic legacy. You know, when the Hanged Man is sentenced by justice to go to the gallows, it's like, you did your crime and now you have to deal with the consequences.
For you were asleep and now you have to wake up.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And so for those of you maybe who are even feeling uncomfortable listening to us talk about all of this stuff, that's fine, that we're entering into this place where we're just going to have, like, it's messy and dirty and we just have to be here and do that. And to do that work together.
100. And it's complex. And one thing, one sentence, or 1 minute of talking on a podcast doesn't even begin to encapsulate the right complexities of everything we're covering. That's another thing I think to think about as well.
So another thing we might want to address is the resurgence of different kinds of divination techniques, different kinds of spiritual practices of yore. Specifically, I'm thinking about the runes, but of course, the Hanged Man, if you listen to our Hanged Man episode, is a diviner, a seer. He gets the gift of second sight. You know, he hangs from the world tree, and in this state of discomfort and suspension, he receives this sacred wisdom, making him able to see beyond the veil. And Odin, in particular, who that card depicts, gets the runes. So many of us have started practicing new divination techniques this year. A lot of people, too, because of the work of amazing activists of color who have been calling white folks in particular to, you know, stop appropriating from their cultures and start to look back to their own indigenous and ancestral roots have started tracing their ancestral lineages and finding the practices that their Neolithic or pre-Christian or pre-colonial ancestors practiced, including divination techniques like the runes and many other traditions of Northern Europe. So,
well, it's just really funny, as you were speaking, I didn't put it together, but this year I started learning Kabbalah with a rabbi.
Right.
I forgot. Like, right. I was like, oh yeah.
Which
I
is, did that. Yeah. Sarah's Jewish. And so she's like looking back to her lineages as well. And also, you know, many people of color are doing this too, of looking to their ancestral roots and finding more about that.
I love that. I also just wanted to speak really quickly to this idea that I think's been popping up as well, which is people realizing that their life is made out of seasons, and that it's not just go, 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 do all the time. Working with our own particular rhythms is very empress. Obeying your own cycles, your own rhythms in service of evolution and enlightenment, I feel like that's Empress and Hanged One right there together. So if you're listening to this, and this idea of you work really hard and then now you're feeling more like you have to rest for a while, or that there's certain times of year or even certain times of the week where you do a lot of your work and then you stop. Maybe you've slowed down. Maybe you've begun noticing your own rhythms more. Maybe you've been called more towards self-care. This could be a subtle or not so subtle influence of these archetypes and these energies. Empress is Venus. She wants to create what she wants to create when she wants to create, not when someone else is telling her to do it or how they're telling her. And the timeline that Venus is on is one that holds sacred, our energy, our pleasure, our sparks, that which pleases us. I think about Adrienne Marie Brown's pleasure activism coming out this year, right? I feel like that's very Empress, Hanged One. That which pleases us is special. It's spiritual. It's sacred. We've been taught to be like ashamed of play or ashamed of pleasure or sensuality. We've been programmed that we need to work all the time and that it has to be hard and we can't have fun doing it and we can't express what is naturally inside of us. You know, like this is really heavy stuff that we've sort of taken in that we need to kind of unprogram on a personal level, you know, and in my opinion, now I'm trying to slowly wake up to this, not having fun or pleasure or expressing ourselves. That's sinful. Like not doing that is shameful in our one life that we get in this body. The goddess wants us to have orgasms and cuddle and express ourselves and have fun and dance and also do work, you know, right? And so
meaningful, beautiful work that is, like, there's so much work to be done.
So much.
There's so much important work to be done. Like, the whole planet needs to be cleaned up. We need to figure out how to make it so that everybody lives lives of purpose and joy.
Yeah.
There's so much ugly stuff that needs to be cleared away. Like, there is enough work for us to do for the rest of our lives and then some, all of us, for the rest of eternity. And it's meaningful, purposeful. Like, yeah. We've got art to make. We've got, like, people to feed. We've got habitats to restore. Like, why are we wasting our time doing ridiculous bureaucratic work that doesn't matter to anybody? These are the questions. But I'm so interested in what you're saying, Sarah, specifically around time and seasons. I've been thinking about that a lot too, about this idea of, you know, celebrating the pagan holidays or the witch holidays, of times of doing your meditation, you know, times when you're like having sex, times when you're taking a walk, times when you're experiencing beauty, as literally resting your time and your life away from the hands of white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, like reclaiming your time, like that this is, that these practices, far from being like a waste of time or a hobby, are in fact, you know, we're governing our lives not by the work calendar, bank holiday, we get the day off. We're doing it by the moon, by the seasons, by the starlight, by the time when the geese come flying back
Or by our disabilities, or by like when we can't do anything or move or work, or just by our own internal seasons. By, yes. You know, if we have grief or depression, or if we're dealing with something internal, you know, there's all of that. And to think that that's bad or shameful or sinful, I just really hope that folks begin rethinking that and loving themselves through those times, you know?
Right. That your reclaiming of your time is a revolutionary act of care for yourself and also care for the world that we live in by respecting and honoring her cycles.
Amanda, give me some hope. What is it like to be in a hermit year?
That's so funny because for those of you who don't know, Sarah's like a year behind me. She's in her strength year. I did my strength year last year. This year I'm in my hermit year. She's going to be in her hermit year next year. Okay, what is it like to move into your hermit year? So I have to tell you, something really interesting has happened for me this year, which is basically, you know, the strength year, I really felt like I was being tested and, you know, I really had to rise to the challenge and like confront my true self and like find the strength I didn't know I had. The hermit year has not been as hard.
Hallelujah.
But I feel like the archetype of the hermit, you know, the recluse, the mystic, has been both a description of my year, but also a direction, like a guide.
Like a North Star.
A North Star that I'm trying to follow, but that I haven't completely mastered yet. Like the hermit retreats in order to be able to really focus and concentrate, but also so that they can express their own relationship to the divine. And I feel like this year has shown me a lot of ways that I allow in distractions and places where I don't trust my own voice. So it's given me a lot to work on. I also really wanted to be single this year, and I keep not doing that.
Because you're so charming.
Oh, well, thank you. But I think it's really that I'm so charmed by other folks. I just am like, wow, you're so amazing and you're so amazing. Anyway, I shouldn't probably be talking about this here, but certainly places there, I've certainly been learning a lot about places I need to establish clearer boundaries and the ability to say no. You know, just because something looks really tempting and delicious, hermits really are able to abstain. And I feel like in general, I'm more of an empress type than a hermit type. I'm like, yum, give me some more of that. But I feel like, you know, I moved into a place all by myself. I'd been living with other people for a decade, and now I'm alone, thank goodness, on a house on a hill. You know, I've been studying a lot, wrapping up loose ends. The hermit is a nine, so it's all about tying up loose ends, closing things out. So I spend a lot of time alone, and I've retreated from a lot of relationships, but also, you know, as relationships, friendships, partners, lovers keep coming, sort of like hummingbird. I have a lot of hummingbirds outside my house, and I feel like there's a sort of hum of relationships around me. So what that's taught me, though, is in this sort of craving to be alone, or desire or intention to be alone, and the fact that I haven't been doing that, I've learned a lot about my habits in relationship to other people and the things that get in the way of my focus and concentration. I have a stellium in the seventh house. Stelliums, for those of you who don't know, are when you have more than three planets in a house or in a sign, and they can often indicate points of obsession. So you might want to look to your own chart. Places where you just, your energy always goes. So I have a lot of energy in the house of relationships and partnerships, and I'm trying to sort of move it into other places. Yeah, so I predict for you when you enter your hermit year that you're going to have that intention of, you know, reflection and concentration and focus, and that whatever comes up for you that gets in the way of that will tell you a lot about where your work is.
Well, it actually sounds like you're working with this archetype really well. When you were speaking, I was thinking about one, we are all so harsh on ourselves. Like, you're like, well, I feel like I wasn't really. It's like, well, everything you're saying, you moved to a place on your own. You're like really taking stock of you and you in relationships. You're really taking stock. Like, you know, the hermit traditionally is this archetype of austerity. So you're really kind of like carving out. There's that block of marble and you can kind of see it in your mind's eye of where you want to go. And you're starting to slowly carve away so that the most perfect embodiment of that artwork, which is your life and which is you, you know, remains. So I also think that that's everything you're talking about is like super, super hermit, you know. And I also think, you know, I've spoken about this many, many times, and I'll speak about it one more time. I really just see the archetypes as 360 degrees. Like, they're a holistic, it's not just one thing. If you're in a hermit year, it could be that, not you, but like listener, it could be that it is a, maybe a little bit of the harder aspects of the hermit or the archetype, you know, which is definitely exactly what happened to me with strength.
Tell me what happened to you with strength. I am desperate to know.
Well, you know, like Amanda, you told me this many times when you were in your strength year and I was in my chariot year, you said, I don't know if you want to go into strength here. Like, you might want to hang out
there. You were warned.
Yeah, stay in chariot. Like, stay in chariot. And I, quite frankly, because I am deeply naive, even though I'm basically a crone at this point, I was like, it's going to be great. I'm going to, like, all of the, like, it's creative. It's vibrant. It's fun. It's pleasure. It's wild. You know, all of these pie in the sky dreams I had of this archetype I was really hoping to have. But of course, tarot doesn't work that way because life doesn't work that only. Way. So, you know, it's been very difficult for me to try to come into a succinct explanation of this year. I'm still like very much in this year and very much in strength. Similar to you, my strength year is trying me. It is testing me. Every week, it was another curveball of another total surprise thrown my way, from small to very, very, very huge, big tests on every level. And I will say that I do thank my past self for setting me up in various ways with the resources to handle this stuff. And I also feel like I really, truly am learning what strength means in every sense of the word. There's been a lot of, for me personally this year, there's been a lot of beginnings of recoveries. I started the year, my chariot year left me in adrenal fatigue, super injured. I could not hold my head upright past 3 p.m. I was almost immobile, basically. I was completely depleted and exhausted. I was confused and I was in a crisis, which I've spoken to you about a lot, Amanda, and I'm not going to talk about it here. That, of course, colors like my strength year, you know. I was deep in chariot and now I'm deep in strength. And what came up for me are a few things. One is this idea of the undefended heart. I spoke about this in the strength episode back in March or February, like right in the beginning of my strength year. This idea of the power of the undefended heart, which is what strength, one of the things that strength asks us to do. And I really tried to practice that, particularly in the moments where previously I would be defended, or previously I would try to numb out, or even previously I would just acquiesce. Like, I'd be like, oh, sure, whatever.
So you in moments where you would have felt like, where you would have reached for a defense, you
of any kind,
of
right?
Any
because
kind.
Because even being like passive aggressive is a defense.
Sure.
Right? Like, sure, no problem. Okay.
But so in those moments, instead of reaching for the thing, you...
I would try to stay honest and vulnerable no matter what. And this ended up being like quiet victories and certainly none that will win me any awards. But I really, really, really tried to have compassion for, let's just say, someone who was attacking me or like saying horrific things that in other instances, I maybe would have not engaged or engaged in a like or a cold fashion. But I really tried to stay vulnerable and I really tried to stay honest.
I'm ready to give you an award for that.
And I did. And I want to be really clear for you gentle listeners. This didn't like solve anything. The person wasn't like all of a sudden like, "Oh, you're being vulnerable and telling me like about..."
Oh, well, that's okay then.
Yeah. It wasn't they weren't like, "Okay, cool. Like let's all like have a parade, you know, and be friends and hug." It wasn't necessarily like that. Obviously, what it did was it started telling me, or it started normalizing vulnerability. It started normalizing compassion and honesty and not reaching for the defense, not reaching for the shield as a numbing device and just as a reaction. You know, the other is a really like really understanding or beginning to understand with this card, this inner heart-led journey that strength kicks off in the second line of the majors. The chariot skids to a halt. We're asked to clarify what we truly value and what our heart wants, not what we were raised to want or not who we thought we were. So this can be like disorienting too. We're forced to like painstakingly try to rewild our heart, ask ourselves about our like innate creativity, ask ourselves like, why did play go away and how can it come back? And this is like so disorienting and it involves a lot of grief. And it involves a lot of patience and a lot of self-compassion. You know, there's this saying that Glennon Doyle says, it's this word like brutiful, that life is both brutal and beautiful, which is very strength for me personally, because my year was so intense. And in fact, it like still is, and so extreme. Like the lows are low, the highs are high, right? But sometimes the high, because I didn't have any defenses or I was trying to take away numbing devices, it was like a quiet moment cuddling my dog or like sinking into the moments of feeling grateful that like a friend thought of me, invited me to go somewhere with them, or like eating good meals with my sweetheart, like little things. You know, the other thing is, you know, I've been in a dark moon period. And so for those of you who've taken my classes, you'll know what I mean. And I won't get into it here, but I've also learned that it's okay to not know. And so I'm also leaning into my dark moon period as well as I am for themes of my card of the year. But you are right, Amanda, like strength is real.
Strength takes no prisoners. And I'm impressed with all the work that you've done. It sounds like you've really like shown up for it. That's really hard to keep your heart open when you're really feeling like you're in the lion's den and there's lions pacing all around you, roaring and burying their teeth. And like to really bear your heart and be present and vulnerable for that that's a huge accomplishment. And I applaud you. And I will give you an award for that. Well, so here we've talked about this. I really encourage all y'all out there to have conversations like this with a friend. You know, pick a friend that you want to talk about, you know, what's your card of the year, and have a convo, go out to lunch, talk about like what's come up for you, what you see in the world around you based on the cards of the year and based on the Empress, based on the Hanging Man, and offer each other some support around this. It's a really good way to get to know the cards better and to make them more personal and to make it more intimate.
Yeah, and we just wanted to close the episode with talking about some ways that you can work with your card of the year in a variety of different ways. You wanna start?
No, you go.
Okay. Thank you for being vulnerable and sharing your needs with me, Amanda. I receive and love that you no matter what.
Oh, thank you.
So the first thing is, well, this is what I want to say first, actually. As we wrap up the Gregorian calendar year of 2019... we have 3 months left, which is actually a long time. A lot of people are like flipping out because there's 3 months left. But I think 3 months is a very long time. I've written books in that time. I've found new apartments. I've gotten laid off and found new jobs. I've fallen in love. You know, a lot can happen in 90 days, right? So don't let the fact that we have 3 months left in this year cause you anxiety. One, because time is a construct and it's all made up anyway. And two, if you want to recommit to your card or cards, there's a couple ideas here to do so to help you. You know, one could be ask yourself, What are some aspects of your card that you haven't yet been able to connect to or embody that would be really beneficial to you? Because as you know, these cards have layers, and there's got to be a couple of things within the archetype of your card you maybe haven't tried. You know, I'll share another brief story about my strength card. Is there was one point in the year where I was just so stressed, let's just put it that way. And I was talking to a mentor of mine, and she said, you know what? Why don't you just try surrendering? You haven't tried that yet, have you? And I was like, holy cow, you're right. Like, I just haven't laid down and been like, universe, I'm, you know, white flag. Like, I got nothing. Like, you know, and it really, I really meditated for months, actually, on what surrendering feels like. On what it looks like, on what it could grant me.
That's beautiful.
And I hadn't thought about that with strength, but Amanda, you and I had talked about it in the gosh darn episode. But you know, it's those things where it's like, I know sometimes we need to be reminded. So just think about, what is some aspect of your card that you just haven't embodied or tried to practice?
Oh my gosh, that is like the total tarot reader's like life story, where your client could be like, why didn't you tell me that this and that? And you're like, I did. I told you that over and over.
We're so good, we even told ourselves and we didn't take our advice.
Oh my God, but that's so true. Like, how many times in your life you ask your friends, but why does this keep happening to me? And they're like, because blah, blah, blah. And then one day you're like, oh, well, anyway. Yeah, so I'm thinking a really good thing for you to do with your card of the year is to plan an adventure where you take an action that your card character would take or do something they would do. So for instance, for me, I'm planning a pilgrimage because it's my hermit year and I want to take some time out to go to the wilderness and consolidate my practice and, you know, commune with spirit and write my own prayers and songs and practice my own rituals and really just trust that I am enough. That's what the hermit is all about. And just listen. So, you know, if you're in your sun year, you might visit an ancient site dedicated to the sun and have a celebration there. Maybe you live somewhere like Stonehenge, or maybe there's somewhere near you that is the, you know, that is a site where the sun would be, a wide open plain. In your lover's year, maybe plan a honeymoon, even if you're just taking your sweet self, or
so cute,
or, you know, chariot year, learn a discipline, go on a bold adventure, go on a road trip. So those are some of the ideas that I have for ways that you can work more deeply with your card. Mm. I'm also thinking you could create an artwork based on your card, write a poem, write a song, get inspired by reading a book or some other text with a character that embodies the character of your card, like the chariot, read about a warrior figure, for instance, like Boudicca, revolutionary Brit, resister of the Romans. The best way, I think, to connect to a card is to do something creative or take an action, you know, like that's just a way to internalize the message and the energy around the card.
Yeah. I also just wanted to add one way to do this is to invoke the support of your card. These archetypes are helpers. They are aides. They are not meant to be distant from you. They are not meant to have power over you. I find that there is a reaction or a sort of misconception sometimes with tarot that it can be sometimes a fear-based experience. Like, for example, you get the hermit and, oh no, I'm going to be single.
Right.
Amanda can attest.
That ain't the truth, honey. So you might be like, I should try and be single.
Right. But there you go. That's it. Just pretend. Yeah. But, you know, I think that there's this sort of like, and it makes sense because this is like how we've been raised. And it's also a lot of times how we've been raised to operate around matters of the occult and things like this, where there's this kind of fear or like this archetype has power over us. But I think it's really important to think of these archetypes as helpers and as guides and as angels. And if you can start thinking of these archetypes as your friend and to invoke their support and to call on their energy in whatever supportive ways you need to remind you that at any time, whether you're in your car or at your desk at work, or you're having a really, really hard day and you're crying in your bed, that you can call on the support of any archetype, whether it's the Tower or the Moon or even Judgment or the Hierophant or even some of the archetypes maybe that you don't necessarily feel comfortable. And I'm just saying this for people who have those maybe as their helper cards, their teacher cards, or the card of the year, right? If you have like the Devil as your card of the year, you know, maybe your first impulse isn't to like cuddle up, although it's ours, but you know, Maybe it's not yours. And just to think about like, how can this card be a helper? How is this card a friend? How do I soften up to the energies of this card that want to help me? Because tarot was invented to help us.
How can I collaborate with this card? You know, I just sort of to wrap up, I am really inspired by what you're saying, because I feel like it really speaks to the meaning of the Empress and the Hanged One. You know, our culture often only sees relationship based on authority and exploitation, you know, power over, domination. So when we think of the tarot cards, we're thinking, oh, they're dominating. I get the Devil card and that means that the devil is interfering with my life. But what if we're, you know, this year, this time when the Hanged One and the Empress are engaging and sort of maybe not wrestling with each other, but dancing with each other, you know, how can we collaborate? How can we create friends? How can we create systems of care within the tarot, within our spiritual life? And we'll leave that to you to answer. Next week, tune in, because we're
talking about the Devil card.
We are working with seduction,
power,
corruption,
and how to turn your demons
into allies. So tune in. Don't forget to buy Sarah's planner.
Don't forget to buy Amanda's book.
And we love you so much. Thanks for coming back.
Witches in season 3, witches near and far, witches eating sandwiches, there's a witch wherever you are.